This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up at 6 on 1A Plus with Jen White, it's this week's International Roundup. Floodwaters overwhelm cities and towns in southern Ukraine. Brazil lays out a new plan to save the Amazon, and the White House welcomes the UK's latest prime minister. It's all tonight at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump is now the first former or sitting president in American history to face a federal indictment.
Adherence to the rule of law is a bedrock principle of the Department of Justice, and our nation's commitment to the rule of law sets an example for the world. We have one set of laws in this country, and they apply to everyone.
That was the special counsel, Jack Smith, earlier today after federal prosecutors unsealed the indictments of former President Donald Trump and one of his personal aides. At the same time, the Republican field of primary presidential contenders continues to grow. This week, former Vice President Mike Pence and former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie both entered the race that now has about a dozen hopefuls. So, what would you like to know about how a frontrunner's federal indictment could affect this presidential race? We are a couple months away from the first presidential debate, which will be held, Republican primary presidential debate, which will be held in Milwaukee. And how are you differentiating the roughly dozen candidates on the GOP side? And how do you feel about Democratic President Joe Biden running for re-election? You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. It's a presidential politics roundup with Julia Azari joining us now, Marquette University Professor of Political Science. And Julia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. What a week.
We are in some uncharted waters here with a former president now facing his second indictment in 3 weeks. This following a court that found him liable and for millions of dollars in a civil case. How, if at all, is this affecting the Republican race for to be the next presidential nominee?
Well, there's a couple different ideas, and this is all really just trying to think it through because, of course, we don't have any polling that reflects the changes, the events of yesterday and the release of the indictment charges today. We'll know more in a week or two. The first indictment, the one that came down in Manhattan a while back, seems to have actually improved Trump's standing in the Republican nomination polls. And this is just a coincidence in time, and it might just be that. But it might also be that this has sort of closed ranks around the president's supporters and kind of reminded them that they support him because he sort of pushes back on established institutions in a way that appeals to them. That might not translate to this latest indictment. It might, again, we're sort of purely speculating. The other piece that is interesting, especially as you point out, as there's a whole bunch of other hopefuls in the field, is this argument about electability and his kind of chances in the general. And it seems that this is, on the one hand, this effect is potentially quite real, that the general public isn't super keen on these indictments and is somewhat concerned about what the former president may have done and sees some room for holding him accountable in the event that these charges stick. But the other piece of that is, will that actually, does that electability argument hold water in the context of the primary? It's not totally obvious yet that is exactly how Republican primary voters are thinking about the different candidates. So those are the sort of two lines of logic that I see there. It seems kind of insane to say that it's not certain that this will affect the nomination at all, but it's possible that that's going to be the case.
Well, but there is also the possibility of a third indictment still to come out of Fulton County, Georgia, about the election.
Yeah, absolutely, 2020. Yep.
Thank you.
I know it's been a week. So I have no idea whether that will happen and in what time frame or what impact that would possibly be. I do think that one of the things we'll learn, I'm probably going to say this phrase a lot during our time together, that things that we will learn because we do not know, because this has not happened, But one of the things I think we'll learn is how much of this in the public mind is about, sort of comes down to, it's all about how people already feel about Trump. Most people know how they feel. It's all about partisanship. It's all about these sort of baked in existing attitudes, versus how much of it is a response to what's actually happened. And the substance of each indictment is quite different and signifies, I think, really different kinds of things that people might be thinking about. And the one in New York, I know, did, you know, struck some people as kind of chained together. You know, it's a financial disclosure charge that is connected to this kind of larger set of potential crimes. And that's, I think, maybe harder for people. It was, you know, I had to read it a couple times to grasp exactly the legal logic of that. And also, not as big of a deal. This 49-page indictment that has been unsealed today, it has much larger kind of implications about national security and classified documents. And there are all these kind of questions about how much that is potentially going to matter. And Georgia would cue in a whole other thing yet about the status of the election after the 2020 votes were cast and counted. And so voters may have very different impressions of each indictment. We may be dealing with very different things, or it may come to kind of down to, as so many things do, kind of what side are you on set of questions that doesn't take the substance into account. We just don't know.
And things we still have to learn. Julia Azari, political science professor at Marquette University, joining us. But what about how these indictments are affecting the rest of the Republican field right now? You had Florida Governor Ron DeSantis defending the former president as a victim of, quote, the weaponization of federal law enforcement. You had Republican candidate and businessman Vivek Ramaswamy saying that he would pardon Donald Trump on day one were he to be elected president. Where you have others like Asa Hutchinson, the former Arkansas governor, who said this is reason enough for him to step aside from the field. Chris Christie, former governor from New Jersey, seems set to at least do what he can to undercut former President Trump. And Mike Pence joined the field of Republican presidential contenders this week, but seems to have had the wind taken out of his sails by all the Donald Trump news today.
Yeah, That's a pretty good rundown. It's quite fascinating to watch a number of these hopefuls. You know, on the one hand, Trump is the person to beat. Trump is the person to run against. And to watch, especially candidates like Pence and DeSantis, whose main project is differentiating themselves from Trump in some way. And so Pence kind of came out the gate earlier in the week trying to differentiate himself from Trump and really to draw a distinction between their reactions to January 6th, which was an interesting choice. But then when it came time to talk about this particular indictment, they very much, I saw something today that sort of put this really succinctly, they very much became, you know, what team are you on and who's part of the team? And on the one hand, this makes perfect sense. That is how political parties work. It's important to remember when we're thinking about presidential primary, it's not the same thing as a general election. It's a party process of people who are ultimately going to share a lot of the same ideas and pull in the same direction. But on the other hand, this is really the key moment to differentiate yourself from, you know, from a pretty major situation going on for the former president. And many of them, with the exception, as you said, of Asa Hutchinson, have kind of opted not to really embrace that tack and instead to close ranks a little bit.
Former Vice President Mike Pence joining the race this week in his campaign announcement in Iowa had this in part to say.
We can defend our nation and secure our border. We can revive our economy and put our nation back on a path to a balanced federal budget. We can defend our liberties and give America a new beginning for life. But it'll require new leadership in the White House and the Republican Party. The crises we face, to borrow a phrase, are all man-made. And that man is Joe Biden.
Julia, you co-authored an opinion piece this week at MSNBC.com about how Mike Pence appears to be trying to take the Reagan Republican lane, and then the question about what that Reagan Republican lane would look like in a 2024 presidential election.
Yeah, I'm a little bit obsessed with this idea of the way that politicians use time as kind of a marker for ideology. And I think politicians in both parties do this, which we wrote about a bit in the piece, that usually when politicians in the past have talked about something being new, new is sort of a word that stands in for kind of moderating and moving to the center and kind of retooling what the party stands for. And you see bits and pieces, kind of elements of that in some of these strategies because the last couple of years have been relatively rough at the national level. For Republicans and maybe especially in 2022, losing a lot of races that they might have expected to win. And I see Pence doing this in a kind of very interesting way. So in that clip there, he talks about new leadership and moving on from the Trump years. But at the same time, he's very interested in sort of moving backwards into this more classical vision of Reagan Republicanism. And ideologically, that's not exactly to the center. But it is to the mainstream. And I think that it's just very interesting to me. And it also highlights something that I feel like we don't hear a whole lot about, sort of gets absorbed in a lot of the sideshow of day-to-day politics, but that there are some real emergent fissures in the Republican Party around Trumpism and foreign policy. And the kind of sense of what the country will be in the world and how it will operate, that the substance of Reagan's administration, and how it operated in the world, how it thought about alliances, that's very, very different from a more sort of populist and inward-looking Trump kind of approach, and that all really comes to a head in the Russia situation and in kind of doubling down on support for Ukraine versus pivoting to more accommodation of Putin and Russia. And those are very important and substantive issues. And there are disagreements ideologically, I think, to some degree, within both camps, but especially among Republicans. And that's an area where Pence also really breaks with his former running mate.
Julia Azari, our guest, professor of political science at Marquette University. We're looking at the field of presidential candidates with the unsealed indictment today of former president and current candidate Donald Trump. Get your reaction when we continue at 1-800-642-1234. What do you see in this presidential field as it now stands, and what will you be watching for going forward? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our conversation with Julia continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our conversation with Marquette University political science professor Julia Azari. We're looking at the broad field of presidential contenders for 2024. We're taking a look at the news today about the unsealed 37 felony count indictment against former president and current candidate Donald Trump, and what that may do to upset the field or how it may be maintained. And how do you feel about the federal agents indicting a former president? Who would you like to see get the GOP nomination? You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Watching the Sunday morning talking head shows over the weekend, Julia, one of the things that stood out to me was a guest on Meet the Press, Senator Mike Rounds from South Dakota, saying that he wouldn't commit to supporting a Republican presidential candidate unless that candidate were Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina. He hasn't gotten a lot of attention or notice so far in the Republican presidential contending race, but that certainly stood out to me. What did you make of that statement?
Well, that's interesting. That's a good point. Scott has sort of fallen off the radar with all the hoopla of this past week, but he is a really interesting candidate. I mean, we'll see. I think he makes as much sense as a number of the other candidates in the race, and maybe even more, in terms of kind of bridging both the kind of Trump wing of the Republican Party and the more traditional wings. Pence is really throwing his lot in with the more traditional wing, which is tricky since he was in the Trump administration. We also haven't talked a lot about Chris Christie, who's a New Jersey Republican, which means that long before Trump was on the scene, Christie was sort of, had worked with Democrats a lot, being in a more Democratic part of the country. And, Tim Scott has done some bipartisan work, is an African American Republican, which is unusual in Congress, and has worked some on race issues. Has also taken some more conservative stances on that. You know, this is very interesting figure, and it is very interesting to see one of his Senate colleagues make that kind of endorsement and have that not be from someone, for example, from his own state. So maybe he's a sort of quiet alternative to Trump. I think that one of the things that's not very sort of theoretically interesting to talk about, but is nevertheless true, is that name recognition counts for a lot in primaries like the ones that we have that go on for a long time and cost a lot of money. And Scott is, you know, has maybe a even more of an uphill battle than some of the other longer shot candidates. And that's a little bit challenging. He's sort of seems in some ways like some of the members of Congress who were trying to get the Democratic nomination in 2020 and just didn't have the kind of name recognition liftoff, even though they were interesting candidates.
Which is why his name popped out to me when it came up on Meet the Press on Sunday. I was rather surprised. Let's go to your calls now with our guest, Julia Azari, professor of political science at Marquette University, at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lauren Madison, you're on the air. Good afternoon.
Well, hi. I heard you mention the perennial problem of kind of firebrand candidates who not necessarily a majority of voters support in the getting the nod in the primary. And I'm wondering why I am not hearing at all in the press from experts like yourself about the institution of ranked choice voting, which would pretty much eliminate that problem altogether.
I would love to hear a political scientist take on ranked choice voting. Now, this is where you don't just mark a box, but you rank the candidates by the way you see them. And then there can be runoffs so that if your first top candidate isn't selected or isn't among the contenders, that you would actually still not be throwing your vote away, but would still have a chance to have your vote count towards one of your other top ranked candidates. Julia, what do you think of ranked choice voting?
I guess, I mean, I hear other experts talk about it all the time, and if you want to hear more about it, I would suggest checking out some work by my colleague and good friend Lee Drutman at New America, as a think tank, and he's written a lot on this topic. I mean, I think, you know, it plays out slightly differently if we're thinking about a general election versus a primary. One of the ideas with a general election is like it might make things more conducive for a multi-party system. Also, as the caller pointed out, like it might sort of reduce the voice of more extreme candidates at the expense of maybe more sort of moderate and mainstream candidates. I'm really not sure about it all, to be honest. Right now, we have a couple of states and localities that have experimented with it. I don't think it's really conclusive that it's done a whole lot. It might be possible that with these changes would play out over a really long period of time. I think it's possible that, like, there's still people arguing about 2016 because Trump was sort of not a majority favorite. He was kind of a plurality candidate in the Republican Party. Of, you know, what would that have looked like under different voting systems? Would another candidate have been able to consolidate support? And like, people don't agree. So I think it's interesting to explore. I think it's worth thinking about.
But the jury's
out. And certainly
worth
reading up on. But yeah, in my opinion, and I think this is the expert consensus now, that like Maine has tried it, Alaska's tried it, New York City did it in their mayoral election. It's sort of like the jury's out. It hasn't really produced any really stunning outcomes.
We go next to Max in Barron County. Max, good afternoon. You're on the air with Julia Azari. Max?
Hi. Hi. You asked who I was thought would be a good candidate. Just somebody with less background in politics and higher education, a PhD, a doctorate. Biased opinion, I would say doctorate in environmental science, but anything in that higher education range.
Well, that and it's in, I appreciate the call, Max, because there is always this call for we want a politician who's not a politician. And that was Donald Trump in 2016. But right now, you say PhD, and I think Cornel West, who is going to run on the People's Party ticket, who's a PhD and taught at Harvard and Princeton. But that certainly seems to be among the third parties and the longest of long shots. But the idea of a non-politician running for political office, what do you think, Julia?
Well, I think everyone's got to start somewhere, right? So eventually, so you always have to, you know, run for your first office. I don't see anything really wrong with people being in office for a long time, and there are trade-offs. You learn a lot in office. You learn a lot about how public policy works. I think the caller is expressing a very interesting view, which is sort of like a mixture of anti-politician but very pro kind of like expertise and subject matter. I think this is really interesting. I haven't thought about it. I very rarely hear people say they want to hear more from PhDs in any context. I think that's super interesting. I think that people who want to get into politics from another field would do well to kind of start local and work their way up. Presidency is a big job for someone without kind of public service and political expertise.
But working your way up makes you a politician, right, Julia?
It does.
Yeah. So it's kind of you're in a bind, and maybe for president, you'd want somebody who has some political experience to step into it. And I apologize, we're out of time, but we could talk about this all afternoon. Julia,
Absolutely. Thank you
so much for yours today.
Yeah, thank you.
Julia Azari is professor of political science at Marquette University. Hey, Rob Ferret returns to Central Time on Monday, and he'll be taking a look at some of the most recent series finales and why it's so hard to say goodbye to good TV. Join Rob as he has Brian Carr back joining him on Monday from 3 to 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, coming up after the news, an oncologist joins the show to explain how the nationwide shortage in chemotherapy drugs is impacting cancer patients here in Wisconsin. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and it's all about prep-ahead meals to take camping or anywhere in the great outdoors. We'll learn some helpful tips and delicious recipes for dining away from the comforts of home. First, we take a look at a nationwide supply shortage of chemotherapy drugs. Doctors in 40 states now say that at least one chemo drug is in short supply. That, according to a survey last month by the Society of Gynecologic Oncology, doctors are rationing drugs, reportedly switching drugs when they have to, and it could be causing patients' quality of life and chances of recovery as a result. So we're talking about the national shortage of chemotherapy drugs this afternoon. And if you or a loved one are currently undergoing cancer treatment, if your cancer regimen's been affected by some of these shortages, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. If you work in the field of oncology, let us know what you're seeing today at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Carrie Wasinski is the professor and chief of hematology, medical oncology, and palliative care at the UW-Madison Department of Medicine. She is also associate director of clinical research and co-lead of the breast cancer disease-oriented team at the UW Carbone Cancer Center. Dr. Wasinski, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me here today to discuss this really important topic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very curious what you're seeing. We've seen the numbers and the stats, but what are you experiencing in terms of shortages in your practice?
Yeah, so like what's going on nationally, we here at UW Health and the UW Carbone Cancer Center have also experienced a shortage of one particular chemotherapy called carboplatin, and a little bit of a watch, what I call, on another drug called cisplatin. These are both shortage of drugs that are known to be in shortage nationally. We have been doing well with some of the other chemotherapies that are on national shortage, but we have had both carboplatin and cisplatin that I've been keeping an eye on.
And what do carboplatin and cisplatin do, Dr. Wyszynski?
Yeah, great question. So both of these are within the platinum class of chemotherapy, which really attacks how DNA is replicated in cancer cells and therefore has anti-cancer effects, used for many different types of cancer. So everything from lung cancer to breast cancer to ovarian cancer, bladder cancers, and some pediatric cancers.
Dr. Wyszynski, are there viable alternatives to these drugs if they are in short supply or they are without entirely?
So sometimes you can switch from one chemotherapy to another chemotherapy. So like I said before, here at the University of Wisconsin, we've been more experienced a shortage with carboplatin and cisplatin we're in better supply of. And so we know that those two can sometimes be interchangeably used, not always, but sometimes. And so that exchange can be made. And then sometimes for cancers, there are equivalent other chemotherapy options. And so we have been looking to identify when there is an equivalent option, whether we should use that instead for that individual patient.
So have we seen doctors reducing dosages of drugs or switching to others at this point already? And is this something that we expect to continue?
It's a good question. We have definitely been taking the approach of switching to equivalent alternative medications more than reducing the dose intentionally upfront. We've done other actions to also conserve drug, conserve the chemotherapy. So for example, sometimes we would release a chemotherapy before a patient would arrive here to be able to make their process in the day here more quick. But if we aren't sure that they'll absolutely meet the treatment parameters that day, you know, we're holding and not releasing that that chemotherapy until we know that they're definitely getting it that day so that we don't end up wasting any additional medication.
Dr. Kerr, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to reintroduce you quick, but if you had more to add to that, I'd be interested in hearing it.
Yeah, so, you know, I think the hardest thing that we've had to make decisions about is that sometimes we don't have an alternative that is as good. And, you know, often when we're thinking about chemotherapy, it's a course of chemotherapy. So not just what I'm giving to that patient today, what I'm going to be planning to give over a course of several months. And I think one of the most difficult decisions we've had to make, me working with my patients as an individual physician, is, you know, do we start on a treatment course knowing that it's possible that in the next few weeks we wouldn't have that medication versus do we go with a different approach that maybe isn't quite an equivalent alternative, but at least I know we'll have the full course of.
So if you change course throughout the chemotherapy treatment, does that change the efficacy of that treatment, Dr. Wyszynski?
It depends, I guess would be my answer to that. So sometimes, no. Sometimes if you switch to an equivalent similar agent and it's in the same class like cisplatin and carboplatin, sometimes no. But sometimes it can. And so I think it's a very much a decision that each physician needs to make with their the patients and their families. In the situation that they're facing.
Dr. Kerry Wyszynski, our guest, professor and chief of hematology, medical oncology, and palliative care at the UW-Madison Department of Medicine, also associate director of clinical research and co-lead of the breast cancer disease-oriented team at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. And we invite your experiences and stories if you are in the oncology field, if you are a patient with cancer and have seen some of the effects of these shortages. We welcome you to join us at 1-800-642-1234. Is this something you've seen in your practice before, Dr. Wyszynski?
That's a really good question. Yeah, this is actually something that we've been experiencing over the last several to many years in oncology.
Wow.
It's also being experienced in, you know, some of our related fields outside of oncology. So these are generic chemotherapies. And in the U.S., in the United States, the production of these generic chemotherapies occurs really at a few facilities. What led to this issue was that inspection at one of these facilities led to a safety or quality issue, and that shut down that production line. And because it's only produced at a few places, there wasn't the ability to ramp up that supply in a quick way. And so we've seen this with other chemotherapy drugs. There are others that we're concerned that might continue to be affected in the next few months. So really what our national organizations, our national oncology organizations, our national pharmacy organizations have been doing is working with our policymakers in our national government to really increase the awareness on of the importance of having consistent production of these generic chemotherapy agents so that we don't run into these types of issues again in the future.
Why aren't we seeing more places produce these generic drugs, Dr. Wyszynski?
You know, I don't know if I have a complete answer to that. You know, what has occurred is that the number of companies that produce generic medications in general, but generic chemotherapy specifically, has decreased over the years. And so, you know, when one production line or one facility is not able to make it, there isn't the ability to ask another company to step in and increase their production.
So, with the shortages, do you expect them to continue, and are you operating under the assumption that they will continue and get worse?
So the good news for us here at UW Health and the UW Carbone Cancer Center is that we have now secured some additional carboplatin. And like I indicated before, we've been always in a good supply of cisplatin. So I think we're in the position right now that we're cautiously optimistic that you know, everybody who is being treated with these chemotherapy agents or that needs to come in and start treatment with these chemotherapy agents that will be able to do it. We do worry, though, that we don't have a definitive supply chain. We don't know for sure that you know, our order in a week or 2 or 3 weeks is definitely going to come in. So we're still being, I think, cautious in ensuring that we limit waste and that we use alternative regimens when possible.
Dr. Carrie Wyszynski is joining us, Professor and Chief of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care at the UW-Madison Department of Medicine. We're talking about the current shortage we're seeing in chemotherapy drugs, and we are seeing a few here in Wisconsin. And if it's something that you've experienced, if you're undergoing cancer treatment, if you have questions, if you are a cancer survivor, what would you like to see change here to prevent more chemotherapy drug shortages in the future? What are your questions about cancer and cancer treatments for our guest? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation with Dr. Wyszynski continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation about chemotherapy drug shortages and how they're affecting cancer patients. Our guest is Dr. Carrie Wyszynski, Professor and Chief of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care at the UW-Madison Department of Medicine. And we invite you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What do you want to know about cancer treatment and recovery from our guest oncologist today? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. And Dr. Wyszynski, you mentioned, alluded to the fact that these shortages in part are because drug production was paused following an inspection that raised some concerns about the production of these drugs. How do you interpret that as an oncologist? What does that mean to you?
Well, I think every medication that we prescribe, we want to make sure that is manufactured in a safe way so that we know when we're prescribing and delivering that agent that it is, you know, past its quality inspection. So the FDA's clearance of this type of production is incredibly important. And one of the limitations that we know we face with many of these medications is that also impacts the ability to import from other countries. So, you know, recently, just this week, the FDA did announce that they are going to allow temporary importation of some of these chemotherapy drugs, the cisplatin, carboplatin, from other countries. But this is really important to ensure that we have safe, high-quality medications that we are giving. On the other hand, when you know this leads to a shortage because we can't increase production of a high-quality product, that is really you know, disappointing in the United States, where we should have really high quality access for all of our patients.
And are you confident about the quality of the imported carboplatin and cisplatin that'll come to the United States?
I am. I think the FDA is a reliable organization that will only allow importation of high-quality products.
Let's go to your questions now for our guest, Dr. Carrie Wyszynski at 1-800-642-1234, where Allie in La Crosse is standing by. Allie, good afternoon.
Hi there.
Hi, what do you have?
So I'm an infusion pharmacy technician, and so I make all of the chemotherapy drugs that the patients receive. Like, I physically put the drugs into the bag and stuff. And I just wanted to bring up the point that I don't think a lot of people realize that a lot of times we're throwing away vials of medication because we can't vial share between patients due to how it has to be billed through insurance. So it's just, you know, as a tech, you know, you see the shortages of medication, and it like breaks you a little bit having to throw away essentially a full vial of medication because it's, you know, we only needed 5 milligrams out of a 200 milligram bottle, and we have to throw the entire thing away because of how it has to be billed through insurance. So I don't know what the answer obviously is, but I definitely think it's a point that like should be brought up.
Allie, thank you for bringing up this point. And Dr. Wyszynski, what about the waste involved in the supplying of chemotherapy drugs and the inability to vial share?
Yeah, thanks to Allie for bringing that up. And thanks also for what she does, because I know that that's an important part of our care delivery for patients as well. So, you know, there are some ways to adjust to that. You know, we try to minimize waste. And so, you know, I think that if there is a very small amount that is going to come out of a vial, and we don't think that that small amount is enough to have an impact on a patient's care. So, you know, if it's a less than a certain percentage, that we know that that is never going to be an impact on how well the chemotherapy works for that individual's cancer, then we try to conserve that vial. So there are some system approaches that can be done to limit that waste. But I think Allie brings up really good points that there are opportunities for us to think about ensuring that we give chemotherapy safely, because ultimately that is a high priority, but also limit waste.
Dr. Carrie Wyszynski, Professor and Chief of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care at the UW-Madison Department of Medicine, our guest. Your calls continue at 1-800-642-1234. Karen in Madison joins us next. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having this educational program. I'm wondering, what is the cost difference between when pharmaceuticals got full price for their drugs and the generic drugs? What's the difference in the price that the pharmaceutical companies get for these things? Wondering if that's causing them to no longer make the drug. And there was one other question, only I'm having trouble with my memory. So.
Well, let's ask that question of our guest, Dr. Wyszynski, and how much of this has to do with the business of pharmaceuticals and the money that is made or the differential with generics, Dr. Wyszynski?
Yeah, I do think it's a lot of what is occurring right now. You know, when we think about the production of generic medications, generic chemotherapy in this setting, the margin, how much a pharmaceutical company makes from the production of that drug and this ultimate sale and delivery is less. And so the incentivization of those companies to make these types of agents is lower. So that's really where we have to think about our national policies and how we might, as a nationwide effort, incentivize the production of generic chemotherapies and other generic medications because they're important for our patient care.
Thank you. And Karen, thank you for the call. We continue with your questions next with Kim and Madison joining us. Kim, you're on the air with Dr. Carrie Wyszynski.
Hi. My question is, my husband has bladder cancer and he's been treated with BCG coming up on 2 years. And I know not in the Madison area, but nationwide, there had been a shortage of BCG, and so they were cutting the dose or using other medications. And his urologist had said that they've used gemcitabine and docetaxel and are having very good results with that. And I'm just wondering whether the UW is using gemcitabine and docetaxel instead of BCG or as an alternate to BCG, and what your thoughts are on that.
Dr. Wyszynski, do you are you familiar with that?
So that is not my area of expertise, so I am not familiar with what we are using in a replacement there. You know, I can talk a little bit to how we in general approach these drug shortages. So if there is a shortage predicted or a potential shortage occurring, you know, first of all, we try to identify potential shortages early and, you know, pre-purchase as much as we can to have access for our patients. That's always our priority. And then, like I was mentioning before, if there isn't sufficient supply, if we don't have enough of the drug, and then we really try to identify alternatives. So as the caller was alluding to, you know, things like other chemotherapy agents or other treatments that might be a reasonable alternative, hopefully as good at a treatment, but sometimes not as good. And we have to figure out what is the best plan with the resources we have.
Dr. Wyszynski, June is Cancer Survivors Month, and one of although we've been talking about these drug shortages, it should not go without mentioning that our cancer survivor rate has increased dramatically. The more we know, the more we screen, and the more we treat, the more access to healthcare we have. And so what has that been like from your standpoint as an oncologist to see more and more people being able to survive with a cancer diagnosis?
It's been a really exciting part of my career, I guess is what I'll say. I've been doing this for almost 15 years now, and to be able to see continual advances in how do we make early cancer diagnoses, screening, how do we treat cancers better, how do we help those people who are impacted by those cancers, you know, be more likely to survive their cancer diagnosis, have a better quality of life after their cancer diagnosis. Those aspects have been really, really rewarding to see.
And what are some of the new therapies on the horizon of cancer treatment? And what are you looking for into the future of your practice?
Great question. So I think there's a few really exciting recent developments in cancer treatment and things that are coming. So first, I think, you know, we've really seen immunotherapy have a huge impact on how people are doing who are living with cancer at this point in time. We already have seen this for multiple different types of cancer. And I think we are continuing to learn how to leverage the immunotherapies for additional patients impacted by cancer. So how do we do that even better? Second, I think that there's some really interesting and exciting research and newer treatment or newer testing platforms coming out where we're looking at blood based DNA, but looking for tumor DNA in the blood. And so this is now being looked at for early cancer diagnosis, almost like a screening test. This is now being looked at for monitoring how well people are doing on active cancer treatment. And in the survivorship realm, looking to see if we can identify earlier if the cancer is recurring or not, and then can we do alternative treatments to not have that cancer recur. So I think these circulating tumor DNA blood tests are really exciting. I think they're very early, but they are an exciting future direction.
Hey, Dr. Wyszynski, thank you so much for joining us today, and I very much look forward to having you back again.
Well, thank you for having me, and I do think this is an incredibly important issue. So I hope that all of us continue to advocate for national improvements.
Dr. Kerry Wyszynski, Professor and Chief of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care at the UW-Madison Department of Medicine. Also Associate Director of Clinical Research and co-lead of the Breast Cancer Disease-Oriented Team at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. She joined us today to take a look at the ongoing chemotherapy drug shortages we're seeing across the country and right here in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, we're taking Food Friday into the great outdoors as we learn better methods and new recipes for cooking at the campsite. You got a campfire? And we got the recipes for you. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.